And this is my friend Robert Wayne, who will be sharing this session, or at least that's what would have been said until this morning, when Peter Gowan suddenly found he couldn't make his lecture here. With his apologies, and so at the last minute, I, Robert Wayne, and Ken Tavern decided that we would make use of the opportunity to talk about a subject of much interest to us, and I hope to leave it to you, namely the WTO and the Hong Kong ministerial meeting that's coming up in just a few weeks. You will have seen in the press and the Financial Times, other journals, lots of discussion, worried discussion about the impending breakdown of the negotiations in Hong Kong. Martin Wolf, in a recent essay in the Financial Times, said it would be a catastrophe if the negotiations in Hong Kong were not successful, if the Doha round failed. It would be a catastrophe for the world and for developing countries in particular. And last week I wrote a letter to the Financial Times, which they did actually publish, critiquing Martin Wolf's argument. So this is a very hot topic, and Ken in particular has been doing work now for several years on various aspects of the WTO, in particular the TRIPS agreement. TRIPS stands for Trade-Related Intellectual Property. So because of the impending meeting and the prospect of failure and all kinds of blame passed backwards and forwards, and also because simply WTO has been described as the world's most important multilateral organization, a description that I myself would tend to agree with. I do think it's the most important in terms of having the greatest impact on developing countries. Whereas Martin Wolf, who describes it as the most important, says it's the most valuable, the one most important to protect, I would question that part of it. I think it has become quite a dangerous organization for developing countries. So what I'll do now is to give some background on the WTO and the Hong Kong meetings. It is what is called a ministerial meeting. The constitution of the WTO calls for ministerial meetings every 2 years. They're called ministerial because trade ministers and similar kind of ministers, politicians from the member countries come, and they not only have formal authority to make decisions, they not only have formal authority, they have real negotiating power. In fact, the real negotiating power in the WTO is with the politicians, not with the officials. And that's a very, very important point. Makes a major difference in the governance of the WTO as compared to, say, the World Bank and the IMF. And I want to come back to this point and raise the question of whether that is the fundamental weakness of the WTO, even though it appears to have greater, making the WTO more accountable than the other organizations. So the Constitution requires for ministerial meetings every 2 years. There was the famous debacle in Seattle in 1999, there was the one in Doha in 2001, which launched the so-called Doha trade round. There was the failure in Cancun, Mexico in 2003, and this next one in Hong Kong in 2005. And one of the questions that we want to address is, why is this round said to be in trouble? Paul Wolfowitz, the new president of the World Bank, said recently, again in the Financial Times, the Doha development round of trade talks will be judged by one simple test. So this is the Wolfowitz or World Bank test of the success in the Doha round. Does it enable poor people in poor countries to sell more of their goods overseas? Not to sell more of their goods, but to sell more of their goods overseas. That's the test of the Doha round. And he gives us the rationale for this, the proposition, it is trade It will allow poor countries to generate work. Trade will allow poor countries to generate work. And the negotiating principle, he also says in this article, the negotiating principle is the principle of reciprocity, and therefore he urges the US and the EU and Japan to reduce their protection and subsidies on agriculture, and, quote, in turn, the key phrase is that in turn, developing countries need to open their markets and services and manufacturing. So that's the deal that he sees the Doha Round is being about. The rich countries reduce their protection on agriculture, and the developing countries reduce their protection on manufacturing services, so that the rich countries can sell more manufacturing services to the developing countries. That's the deal. So it's not that comment indicates not just the principle of negotiations, namely the principle of reciprocity, we will do this if you do that, but also the sectors, the sectoral balance of negotiations. We reduce protection on our agriculture, and you reduce protection for our manufacturers and services. And in the Financial Times, an editorial a while ago made this reciprocity principle very, very clear. This is what the Financial Times editorialized. This is what it said. Developing countries cannot have it both ways. Unless developing countries are ready to open their markets, it is unrealistic to expect industrialized ones to do so. So unless developing countries are prepared to open their markets, the advanced countries will not open their markets. It's unrealistic to expect them. That is the principle of reciprocity. Just before I put this down, let me say in parenthesis, just before I came here, I opened a packet which contained this book. This is not about WTO, it's about the IMF and the World Bank, and it's called Reforming the Governance of the IMF and the World Bank. And this book contains a lot of essays specifically on the question of how to increase the role of developing countries in the governance of the World Bank. The editor, rather, is Ariel Bura, B-U-I-R-A. Reference at the end. So, what I'm arguing is that developing countries in Hong Kong should not accept this framing of negotiation. They should even be prepared to walk away and then put their weight later behind a new trade round, which is framed in a different way. And this argument, this conclusion, rests on a number of propositions. First proposition is that the benefits to developing countries of the advanced countries lowering their agricultural protection are very much exaggerated. Benefits are much smaller than claimed. And secondly, framing the negotiations in this way leads the developing countries into a number of traps. The first trap is what I call the trade trap. The second trap, which is really just a more specific version, is the agricultural trap. And the third trap is the reciprocity trap. And so what I want to do is to just elaborate on this argument, but begin a bit further back. My critique of the WTO, but also of the World Bank and the IMF, begins with the proposition that the world economy, as it is constituted, as it is organized, the architecture of the world economy since the breakdown of the Bretton regime, is not actually working very well for the poorer three-quarters of the world's population by several indicators of outcomes, such as economic growth, such as inequality, such as poverty reduction. That's proposition number one. And yet, in this time, the world has moved very strongly in a neoliberal or Washington consensus direction. And the mandates of these multilateral economic organizations like the WTO, the Bank, and the Fund are all about promoting further this shift in this market liberal direction. But the conjunction of these two points, the world center of gravity in economic policy, has shifted in this liberal direction, and the world economy is not delivering well to developing countries, the conjunction of those two points leads to the conclusion that the mandates, the agendas of these multilateral economic organizations like the WTO need to be reassessed. On the other hand, I would also accept the corollary. If there was good evidence that the world economy, as currently configured, as architected, is delivering well to the poorer 3/4 of the world population, I would say this agenda is the right agenda. We should indeed press on with it. Now, that is Martin Wolf's argument, and I dispute his and the World Bank's interpretation of the performance of the world economy. That's where the disagreement lies. But if I did not, if I agreed it was delivering, then I would accept this was the right direction. In other words, I have a lot of sympathy for what you could call liberal values, but I just don't think that neoliberal economic policies will deliver on those liberal values. Martin Wolf also agrees with liberal values, but he thinks that the liberal policies will deliver the liberal values. That's the difference between us. The second background point is that this whole agenda of market liberalization, privatization, deregulation, and so on, opening to the world economy, that whole agenda is based on the theory of comparative advantage. And I would guess that even today, after the development of strategic trade theory and all that, most economists, especially in Britain and the United States, and in multilateral economic organizations, most economists would say that free trade is the right policy, especially for developing countries which don't have the capacity to operate a more strategic trade policy. So because they don't have the capacity, they can't get whatever benefits there might be from strategic trade policy. Therefore, free trade is the best policy. But the theory is really seriously flawed, and it is just amazing to me that this is probably the most influential economic theory of all time, even though it is so obviously flawed. Just for one thing, the theory, the idea, remember, reduced to its simplest, is that if you have two countries, England and Portugal, both producing wine and textiles, then after trade, England specializes in textiles, Portugal specializes in wine, and the consumption of textiles and wine can go up in both England and Portugal, therefore trade is better than no trade. That's the essence of the argument. One of the problems with it is that even in a more complicated version, it assumes full employment. All the time, resources are fully employed. But in the case of developing countries, that simply bypasses the big problem, the problem of massive unemployment. The second basic problem with the theory is that it takes no account of the fact that different kinds of activities have quite different growth potential. It's not incidental that Ricardo, despite his name, was actually English. And he thought that England should concentrate on textiles and Portugal should concentrate on wine. The point being that textiles has much greater growth potential in terms of linkages with other sectors than winemaking has growth potential. So that if the two countries specialize in England in textiles, Portugal in wine, England gets to have the much better growth prospects than Portugal does. But the theory doesn't take account of such dynamic factors as that. And the third point about the theory is that it flatly runs against the empirical evidence, that the process of economic development is basically a process not of specialization, but of diversification, a process by which national economies fill in the cells of their input-output matrix. They come to have an input-output, a national input-output matrix, which is denser and denser in terms of transactions between sectors within the national territory. That's what I mean by diversification. The empirical evidence is very clear that the process of development consists of the process of diversification, not the process of specialization, right up until per capita income levels reach the level of Ireland or something like that, the bottom levels of Erie City, Ireland of the early 1990s. So that is to make a kind of postage stamp critique of the basic ideas that are driving this neoliberal agenda, working from consensus agenda. And my point is simply that it suffers from major conceptual and empirical weaknesses, and yet it is the foundation. Now let me come closer to the Doha round. The first critique I make is that the promised trade benefits to developing countries of the advanced countries radically lowering their agricultural protection, removing protection in the EU and in the US and in Japan. The promised benefits to developing countries are very much less than is claimed to be the case. The people who claim large benefits to developing countries, such as Martin Wolf in that paper, in that essay in the Financial Times a couple of weeks ago, rely upon World Bank estimates from some years ago. Not World Bank estimates, World Bank projections of the gains in the year 2015. So that's a long time out. The problem is that, first of all, Martin Wolf and other people use these projections as though they have all the authority of a message from God to the Israelites, as though they are sort of written in stone. In fact, if you look at the way these projections are made, they contain assumptions that are simply wildly implausible, which end up by exaggerating the benefits and simply omitting costs, significant costs to developing countries. Such as, for example, these models omit the costs of the developing countries surrendering infant industry nurturing effects. By agreeing to the Doha round negotiation, in which developing countries agreed to continue to keep off the national policy menu industrial policies that earlier were important for the industrialization of the now advanced countries. A whole lot of costs are simply of a whole lot of costs of developing countries specializing more in agriculture and getting out of industry are just removed from these projections. And that's one way by which net benefits come to be bigger than they should be. But that's the first point. Second point is, even taking projections at face value, the bank's own projections show that the gains to developing countries overall, the net gains, are pretty small. For example, even taking the figures at face value, developing countries have an increase in their GDP by 2015, this is low in middle income countries, of only of less than 1%, substantially less than 1%. Wolf gives a misleading impression by simply quoting billions of dollars rather than putting those billions of dollars in the context of GDP. When you make that comparison, the percentage increase to GDP turns out to be very small, even except taking the figure at face value. And then there's a question not just of the overall gain, net gains, but of the distribution of gains. And it turns out that less than a dozen developing countries, even according to the World Bank models, less than a dozen developing countries get almost all the gains from rich countries reducing their agricultural protection. And many developing countries, the food importing countries, would actually be net losers from this radical liberalization of agriculture in the advanced countries. Many developing countries would be net losers. That's my first big critique. My second big critique is that the way that the Doha negotiation was structured, we in the advanced countries reduce our agricultural protection, and you reduce your protection on your manufactured goods and your services. That way of structuring the negotiation leads the developing countries into what I call the trade trap. What it does, remember Wolfowitz's test of the Doha round. It will succeed if it enables people in developing countries to sell more of their goods overseas, stress overseas. A whole idea is that an increase in trade, GDP, is a major driver of economic growth. The aim of developing country governments must be to shift more of the economy's resources into trade, into exports, and allow then a greater flow of other things to come in the form of imports rather than being produced domestically. And this seems to me very dangerous. In particular, there is not much evidence that trade liberalization is itself a major driver of economic growth, nor is it the case that countries with higher levels of trade to GDP tend to grow faster than countries with lower levels of GDP. I mean, there are exceptions to this, but I think the empirical evidence, when looked at with any kind of critical scrutiny, is fairly clear that trade liberalization itself is not an important driver. On the other hand, it's also true that as countries become rich, then they liberalize trade. But in this case, trade liberalization is an enabler of subsequent growth rather than an important driver of growth. There's an important distinction between those two kinds of causality. And a lot of research on East Asia, for example, suggests that trade liberalization was not the important driver, but things like public incentives for higher levels of investment were considerably more important than trade liberalization itself in the very rapid growth in Asia. The second trap, the agricultural trap, is really just a more specific version of the first one, the trade trap. And I can illustrate the agricultural trap by referring to another article in the Financial Times, which was about the impact on Latin America of China's rise as a major site of low-wage manufacturing. And the Financial Times article about the impact of China on Latin America cited an analyst who said this. This is a recent article. The China connection, as in Latin America-China trade, could pave the way for Latin America to capitalize on its strengths as a low-cost producer of raw materials, like minerals and soybeans. If that happened, Latin America did concentrate more on its advantages in low-cost raw materials. If that happened, it could open the way to the re-emergence of a development model in Latin America based on the classical economic concept of comparative advantage, rather than on more recent ideas such as import substitution. Everybody is meant to say boo when you hear the word import substitution. And then he finished his analysis by saying, China, because of these effects of encouraging Latin America to concentrate more on low-cost raw material production, China gives a new hope for Latin America to be a viable part of the world economy. I find that absolutely astonishing, but that's what he said. And the point is that it would be absolutely disastrous for Latin American growth, living standards, if it were to kind of back out of manufacturing and industry and concentrate more on soybean and mineral exports. For the reason that I gave earlier, that soybean and logging, the Amazon, and mineral exports are simply not the basis for cumulative growth, for innovation, for higher living standards. Those kind of activities that this analyst holds up as the future for Latin America are the kinds of activities that Thomas Malthus wrote about as posing the great danger to the world, as a diminishing returns. And in contrast to the kinds of activities that Schumpeter wrote about, which are activities with an inherent tendency to innovation and which will support rising living standards. And it's those activities, manufacturing industry, that American countries should concentrate on But the whole structure of the Doha, the whole tenor of the Doha negotiations seems to me to be going against that. And in fact, as you know, these agreements like the trade-related investment measures agreement makes it more difficult for developing countries to use the sorts of industrial policies that were followed in East Asia. More difficult rather than less difficult. And finally, the reciprocity trap. This is the point that the Financial Times made. Unless developing countries are ready to open their markets for manufacturers and services, it is unrealistic to expect industrialized ones to do so. And basically, this runs against an important ethical principle, which was expressed by Kant in the dictum, equal treatment of unequals is discriminatory. Equal treatment of unequals is discriminatory. We have institutionalized that Kantian principle in affirmative action programs within nations, such as gender affirmative action programs, for one. The principle is that people who have predetermined disadvantages, determined by, say, their gender, should appropriately have some special means of advancement in order to offset these predetermined circumstances. And it was the case in the GATT before the WTA was formed in 1994, it was the case in the GATT that developing countries as a category were given the status of special and differential treatment, which meant that they did not have to abide by the norms of reciprocity, simply because they were developing countries, not developed countries. They were way down in the income hierarchy relative to the developed countries, and therefore they should not be expected to reciprocate with every action of the developed countries. The developed countries should make disproportional offers relative to what the developing countries had to offer, simply because they were way up here and developing countries were way down here. They were not equal. Therefore, they should not be treated equally. Well, that principle has more or less gone out the window. So let me just conclude. First of all, the gains to trade to developing countries of the rich countries agreeing to substantially reduce their economic situation. These gains are much exaggerated. And most of the gains to developing countries would go to less than a dozen. So this is not a very good deal for most developing countries. And many developing countries would actually lose from trade liberalization, not just in agriculture, but also in things like textiles. The ending of the MFA, for example, is quite costly for many developing countries because China is gobbling up the market that they previously had accrued before. And the second point is that developing countries should be bargaining for other things that are not really on the negotiating table now. One of them is to revise the TRIPS agreement, and I think Ken will talk about the TRIPS agreement and intellectual property. And there are other things that they should be trying, developing countries should be trying to get on the negotiating table, such as changes in the world financial system, which currently requires developing countries to carry relatively large foreign exchange reserves in order to protect themselves from the threat of financial crisis. And that has direct implications for their trading strategy. Developing countries should be pushing for these and other things that are not currently on the agenda. And the final thing has to do with this point that I mentioned at the beginning about the governance of the WTO. As I said, the WTO is different from other multilateral economic organizations in the sense that the real decision-making power, not just formal authorization, the real negotiating power lies with trade ministers at these biannual meetings. And the problem, although that seems to accord more with our notions of accountability, these are after all politicians, than in the case of, say, the bank and the fund. The problem is, and it's become very clear, is that trade ministers from many developing countries who have very little experience in trade negotiation, very little backup from their home capitals. They come to Geneva, they can easily be bamboozled. And that is, in fact, what happens. It seems to me that this indicates some merit in the idea of taking real negotiating authority out of the hands of ministers, as in the IMF and World Bank, and putting it more in the hands of officials. Now that, of course, is a very controversial line of argument, but it's one that I just want to put on the table. So let me stop at that point and then look at
the right answer.
Well, I wasn't planning on, when I woke up this morning, I wasn't planning on giving a talk about the WTO. I received a couple of phone calls from Robert, an email from Robert, and from Sue Redgrave, so I realized that I would be giving a talk on the WTO. So let me say a few things. What Robert said is correct. I have been working on this topic for a few years, and within the WTO agreement, the one I work the most closely on are things having to do with intellectual property and the TRIP agreement. But I'm not actually going to talk very much about that, because I'm going to, sort of, I want to sort of follow on to some things that Robert said and respond to some of the things Robert said. I want to do two things. First is sort of, I think, sort of dispel some of the myths around the Hong Kong ministerial meeting and the Doha development round, or the Doha development agenda, as it's called. And the second thing I want to do is sort of try to answer some of the questions that Robert posed about why development is sort of in negotiating so enthusiastically in that agreement, but it seems like that's what it has. Why don't they just basically exchange the plane tickets and not show up to Hong Kong? First thing is sort of a few myths. I mean, the notion that failure at Hong Kong next month means the failure of the Doha development agenda is silly. For the simple reason that they'll have another meeting. I mean, if they don't reach the agreement they want in Hong Kong in December, they're already planning another meeting in Hong Kong in January or February. So what happens in December, it's convenient to say that the fate of the world depends on what happens in 5 days in December. But the fact of the matter is the fate of the world and the fate of this agreement don't depend on what happens in 5 days in December, because they can always sort of have another meeting. I think that's an obvious point, but it's one keeping in mind. This isn't their last chance. Okay. Second point is that, which partially I recognize contradicts my first point, is that they're light years away from completing this Doha development round. They're much, much further away than you would think. They're at the point in which what they can't agree on now is they can't agree on the language to use to begin to discuss what should be negotiated. Even if they have a breakthrough in Hong Kong, they still have to negotiate. They're going to be miles away from actually agreeing on sort of the technical. They're trying to reach agreement first on how should we go about figuring out what the formula should be for reducing tariffs. Great, they figured that out. Now they have to figure out what the formula should be for reducing tariffs. Then they have to get the countries to basically make the concessions, or negotiate the agreements. And then, of course, it has to be ratified. And one of the points that everyone keeps on mentioning, which is worth keeping in mind, is that in the US, it has to be done by the middle of 2007. Because in the middle of 2007, the administration, the executive, loses what used to be called Fast Track, it's now called Trade Promotion Authority, which basically means they can send a bill to Congress and Senate in the US, and it either gets voted thumbs up or thumbs down. Without that, what they do is they send a bill to the US, and Congress says, well, we want to change this aspect about, you know, line 73, point B, paragraph 6, on shoelaces. Oh, we want to change this thing about sort of white corn exports, you know, to Central America. Oh, we want to change this. And it's they'll never get it through. So the only way they'll get it through is if they get it through on an all or nothing basis. Regardless of if it's a good agreement or a bad agreement, the only way they'll get ratified in the US is if it gets ratified on an all or nothing vote, and the all or nothing vote sort of expires in the middle of 2007. So they're light years away from negotiating this, from being completed, and there's not all that much time. But the third point is that the failure of the Doha development round is not a catastrophe. And it's not a catastrophe, actually, for three reasons. And there are three reasons that are not, I recognize, entirely consistent with each other, but there are three reasons to think about. The first is the reason that Robert gave, which is basically, you don't think that the WTO has made good contributions to development. or don't think the WTO would make good contributions to reducing inequality or reducing levels of poverty or improving sort of the state of mankind, then not having an agreement that furthers these things is not a catastrophe. That's the point that Robert made. And Robert couched that in terms of a disagreement with Martin Wolf. But I actually think your disagreement with Martin Wolf was much more profound than that. And your letter to the FT was much more profound than that. Because the fact of the matter is that even if you basically accept their argument, which you don't, and I don't either actually, even if you even accept Martin Wolf's argument that basically the world is a much better place because of the last 10 years of the WTO after the Uruguay round, that doesn't mean that more of it is necessarily better. It's, you know, driving fast is good, but it doesn't mean that driving faster is better. Driving faster might get you killed, right? So it doesn't, even if you accept the Martin Wolf logic that the WTO has brought good benefits to the world, it doesn't mean that basically lowering tariffs from, 30%, if lowering tariffs from 40% to 30% is good, it might be, it might not be, that doesn't mean that lowering tariffs from 30% to 15% is just as good or even better. The logic isn't clear there. The third thing, though, is that the reason why sort of the collapse of the Cancun Minutes or the Hong Kong Ministerial or the collapse or the unsuccessful completion of the Doha Round is not a catastrophe for mankind, for the developing countries, for the world, for the global trading system, is that the WTO is not going to go anywhere. The whole idea of the WTO, in contrast to its predecessor, which was the GATT, is that it's a standing organization with a secretariat, with standing councils that meet. They don't have to continue to strike new agreements to continue to go forward. The notion that people use sometimes for they refer to as the bicycle theory, if you don't keep pedaling forward, you fall down. It's not true in the case of the WTO. The building will still be there, the TRIPS Council, the Council on Trading Goods, the Council on, on Health and Phytosanitary Measures, all the infinite numbers of sort of forums that exist in the WTO where things are negotiated all the time. It's not just that they play the computer in this table. Things are negotiated there on a daily basis. These things are still going to be there. It's a standing organization. So again, it doesn't mean that the fate of the multilateral trading system, regardless of what one thinks of the multilateral trading system, the fate of it is not riding on what happens in this realm.
And Ken, by the way, as any cyclist, including you and me, know, if the cycle doesn't keep going forward and you put your foot down, the cycle will not
fall. The cycle will not fall over, thank
you. Yes.
But if the cycle is going very fast and the chain breaks, you might get thrown into the middle of the strand.
That's what happened to Ken about 2 weeks ago.
I'm going to address the bigger points, and I'll try to sort of blow through this in 10 or 15 minutes, which I think sort of gets to sort of what I think is going on and what's driving a lot of the bargaining. Okay. And to do this, this also requires a bit of background as well, but I hope that I can sort of condense this. I have half a page of notes here, so I should be able to get through this decently. I'd like to basically just sort of start with the predecessor to the WTO was the GATT, as Robert said, and as presumably most of you know. And the GATT is the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, or Tariffs and Trade, actually, it's alphabetical. General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And the reason why I'm sort of spelling out the acronym is that it was about tariffs and it was about trade. In other words, it was a very narrow organization. Right? It sort of put countries, how countries manage imports, but particularly the managed import through tariffs. And it was even more narrow than that, because it wasn't just sort of all trade, but it was particularly trade in manufactured goods. So it was a very narrow organization. And over the time that the GATT was created in the late 1940s, until the time in which the GATT was superseded by the WTO in 1995, the remit of this organization, or the scope, as I like to call it, greatly grew. So it grew from trade in manufactured goods, to trade in agricultural goods, to eventually to things like services and investments, and intellectual property, and a number of sort of broad numbers, which is why they have all these councils that meet in the WTO with all these different agreements. And it stopped dealing just with tariffs, but it dealt with sort of all sorts of tariff and non-tariff measures, subsidies, government procurement, anti-dumping regulations, and so on. So the reason why, basically, the WTO has become considered sort of the world's most important economic organization is because it deals with virtually all aspects of countries' economies, and parenthetically, it has almost universal membership, and parenthetically, it has a sort of dispute settlement system, which means the rules are not just sort of getting hit across the back of the wrist with a ruler or something, but they actually, there's some enforcement. But the first point is that it has a huge remit, a very broad scope. I like to think of this whole thing as sort of a bargain. I refer to this in my writing as the Uruguay Round bargain. The Uruguay Round was a set of negotiations that began in 1986 and concluded in 1994, and is what created the World Trade Organization. And the Uruguay Round is where the sort of, if you were to sort of to map the increase in the scope, somehow figure out a way to sort of say, you know, this is how big the scope of the organization was in 1945, sort of was in 1950s, in fact. If you were to somehow map it, you'd get a pretty sort of linear increase until the Uruguay Round, and you had a gigantic spike. So the Uruguay Round is this period of negotiations in which the remit of this organization increases exponentially. And the Uruguay Round was fun kind of bargain. And it's a bargain of essentially what I call sort of a bargain of shallow integration for deep integration. The shallow integration was that the developing countries would get more market access. If shallow integration refers to basically the things that countries do, coordinating policies that affect the flow of goods, the things at the border, tariffs, subsidies, quotas. Deep integration refers to essentially government regulations that don't necessarily have anything to do with trade per se, but they affect trade. So investment regulations, competition policy, intellectual property rights, that's deep integration. Now, the Uruguay Round was based on a bargain. The bargain of shallow integration or deep integration by which the developing countries got more shallow integration. They got more market access, which is what they wanted. It might create a trade trap, which Robert speaks to, but what they wanted was they wanted more market access, and they still want more market access, we'll see in a minute. And the developed countries got more deep integration. They got changes to countries in investment regime, and importantly, changes to countries, how countries dealt with services, which is a lot of basically about government ownership and public services, and then the key thing was how countries deal with intellectual property. Now, I happen to think that the deep integration aspects of the Uruguay Round bargain are much worse than the shallow integration aspects of it. Okay. I agree with Robert's economic analysis. We share our deep skepticism of sort of the power of comparative advantage, both at a logical theoretical level or and also at an empirical historical level. But the real problem in the Uruguay Round from the development perspective is the deep integration, for reasons that, well, no, I'm asking you because I won't have time. But just if you just sort of think about very quickly. You're no longer, when you're going from sort of shallow integration about trade, sort of tariffs and quotas, to deep integration, competition policy, labor standards would be an example of deep integration, intellectual property, investment regimes. You're talking about, again, sort of the core regulatory institutions at the heart of a country's economy. And the question you have to ask yourself is basically, this sort of speaks to the things that you probably hear about week in and week out in DD400 and DD406, are those institutions the drivers of development, or are those institutions the outcomes of development? Because if you think that basically countries sort of change their regulatory institutions as they get wealthier, you're basically saying that basically economic development is the cause of the things that then later get discussed under the sort of in the framework of deep integration. And that's generally the way that most people in the world have always thought about these issues, which is why they say it doesn't make sense for Bolivia to have the same set of rules on investment and competition and labor standards and intellectual property as for Canada, because they're different countries of level of economic development. If you start harmonizing core regulatory things, you're essentially inverting that relationship. You're basically saying that you think that what you need to do is have the same set of institutions, and that will, if Bolivia has the same sorts of core regulatory standards as Canada or close to it, that will allow Bolivia to basically grow like Canada. And that logic is fundamentally flawed as well. More deeply and fundamentally flawed probably than the logic about sort of pursuing your comparative advantage is flawed. And it's why I'm so deeply skeptical about the deep integration agenda. Okay, if I was giving this talk, or when I gave talks like this 2 years ago, say before the Cancun ministerial, it was all about deep integration. 4 years ago, before the Doha thing, it was all about the European Union and the United States wanting more deep integration. They wanted more discussion of intellectual property. They wanted more discussion of investment. They wanted an agreement on competition policy. Where developing countries have been successful is essentially getting deep integration basically off the agenda. What's the Doha, what's the Hong Kong ministerial about? It's about market access and agriculture, shallow integration. It's about non-agricultural market access, basically industrial trade, not a shallow education. And it's about services, which is a deep education issue. So that's the qualification. But generally, if you compare this agenda to what the agenda was 2 years ago or 4 years ago, it's light years difference. Okay. So where the developing countries have succeeded, basically in changing the agenda. I always want to say that I used to make a joke. The joke that I used to make was that when they first started saying we need a new ROM because if we don't ride our bicycles, we'll fall off, it was in 1998. And it was when all anybody could ever talk about was the millennium. Because remember, our computers were all going to blow up and kill us when the millennium came. So they decided to call it the millennium round. But then the millennium came, the millennium went. See, I'm still making my joke, even though I'm not allowed, even though my joke no longer makes sense. That's the beauty of joke. Is that you'll see why it doesn't make sense anymore in a minute. Is that when the millennium came, the millennium left, nobody basically, you know, the world didn't end. And the new buzzword became development. No, everybody likes development now. So they decided to have a new round, they called it the development round. But of course, there was virtually nothing different from what was being negotiated under the Millennium Round than what was being negotiated in the Development Round. There was no difference. The agendas were basically the same. The agenda before Seattle and the agenda before Cancun were hardly any different. It was just they decided to change the label. And a number of people wrote essays saying, where is the development in the Development Round? My joke doesn't make sense anymore because the developing countries they've changed the agenda. You can still say there's not a lot of development in the Development Round. That's what Robert is basically talking about. And I largely agree with him about that. But they have at least changed the agenda. I can no longer say it's just a change of name. There's nothing different between what they're negotiating now and what they were saying they were going to negotiate 2 years ago, because it's different. Okay? They've taken the deep, except for services, the developing countries have succeeded in taking sort of the deep integration, the stuff that worries me the most, off the agenda. Congratulations to them. Well done. Okay. Now, what's going on now? The developed countries, particularly the EU, but also the US, are demanding incredibly high, sort of strong concessions, reciprocal concessions, as Robert explained. We do this, you do exactly, you know, you give up just as much as we give up, but it's in different areas. And the question is, you know, why don't the developing countries just, as I said, just walk away? It costs a lot of money to fly to Hong Kong, and it costs a lot of money to basically bring, you know, lots of delegates to Hong Kong, and rent fancy hotels, and go out, and all that wine they have to drink. Why are they spending their money doing this? Why don't they just walk away if there's nothing in it for them? Now, one explanation for why they don't just walk away is because they think that Robert and I are flush. And in fact, they do think there's a lot in it for them. And if you read sort of, you know, the FT, that's clearly sort of and the Economist, that's the logic. That you would think that is what's, that's the Martin Wolf logic, actually. They're not walking away because they know that basically they have great gains to be made. I think that is actually not true. If you actually look at what the developing countries are sort of negotiating for, they're not giving in to sort of the demands that basically, or put it this way, if the developing countries were believed that what Martin Wolf is writing in the FT is correct, then the agreement wouldn't be at sale. They would reach an agreement quite simply. They wouldn't be so far away from finding agreement. So I don't think it's because they think that R, meaning two of us right now, but we're not the only people, thank heavens, to believe this, think that our logic is out to lunch. I think the reason why they're negotiating so strongly to the nail, especially since, as I said before, they all know that even if the negotiations fall apart, it's not like the WTO disappears, right? Maybe they like the idea of having a standing organization in Geneva, they like having a system with dispute settlement in it, it sort of legalizes international economic relations, it's a good thing, and they're worried that it collapses at Doha basically means the end of that. I already told you why that was wrong. It's not going anywhere. Okay? No one's threatening to sort of shutter up the WTO. So what's going on here? Well, there's two big factors that are driving this that I think are keeping the developing countries not just at the table, but sort of enthusiastically and energetically, actively at the table. And these two things need to be considered jointly. The first is China, and the second is the proliferation of preferential trading arrangements. And again, that's considered jointly. The effect of China is quite simply leads to a scramble for market access. Basically, talking about a country that has sort of an incredible ability to export lots and lots and lots of goods of all different types, low-tech, high-tech, medium-tech, in huge amounts at low cost. And so it's not that, the question is not whether or not the issue is not that, oh, by 2020, everything in the world will come from China. The issue is that as more and more and more manufactured goods come from China, that you have a more intense scramble, a among all the other developing countries to sort of pick up the pieces. So the more intense competition for the remaining market shares. The second thing is the proliferation of preferential trading unions. And this is something that I work a lot of work on. And the issue is that Robert made a big deal in his presentation about reciprocity as one of the core sort of norms of the WTO. The other core, and he's right that it's a core norm, I also think he's right that it's perhaps not an appropriate norm. But the other core norm of the WTO is something, it's non-discrimination, or what's called in international trade parlance, MFN, most favored nation. And bear with me here. What most favored nation means is essentially that every country has to be your most favored nation. In other words, if I say that the tariff on cardboard boxes is 10% for New Zealand, then I have to say that the tariff on cardboard boxes is 10% for every other country that's a member of the WTO. Okay. I can't say it's 10% for New Zealand and 15% for Canada and so on. That's the rule of non-discrimination, most favored nation. Essentially, every country is your most favored nation that's a member of the WTO. But there's an exception to that, and the key exception to that are the WTO allows preferential trade agreements. A lot of you should probably be saying, but wait a sec, cardboard boxes from France can enter Spain at a lower tariff than cardboard boxes, from the US can enter Spain, because Spain and France are part of a preferential trading agreement that's called the European Union. The U.S. isn't party to. Preferential trade agreements allow you to give better than most favored nation access. Now, these things have been proliferating. And one reason why they've been proliferating is because countries are they're scrambling to sort of to pick up the market that's left behind, the shares of the market that's left behind because of the huge export capacity that comes from China. Well, how do you compete? One way to compete with, not necessarily with China, but with your neighbor or somebody else, is basically to have access to the US, but also the European, but principally the US market, that's better than they do. But wait a sec, I can't get access that's better than they do because the US has to give us all the same access because of most favored nation. No, you sign a preferential trade agreement, and then you can get better than most favored nation access, right? NAFTA is a preferential trade agreement. Mexico and Canada have better than most favored nation access than anybody else in the WTO does, except for the other countries that sign these preferential trade agreements. What does this have to do with anything? Well, the US doesn't give away this ultra good access to its market for nothing. It doesn't just say, we'll give you better than most favored nation access. Sure, that's a good deal. It drives a very, very hard bargain. And the hard bargain that it drives is back to what I was saying a few moments ago about deep integration. It makes requests on the deep integration agenda, what I call sort of the regulatory harmonization agenda, that are light years beyond what's required in the Uruguay route. So what you have essentially is many countries in their quest to get better than most favored nation access to the US want it so desperately that they end up basically making concessions at the bilateral or the regional level that's much, much greater than they had already made in the Uruguay round. And in fact, it completely nullifies the gains that I said they had made in the post-Uruguay round period of keeping deep integration off the agenda. You're getting regulatory harmonization through the side door of these preferential trade agreements. But the story doesn't end there. Where the way this links to Hong Kong is that you could just say, well, a rational policymaker might say, hey, Mexico decides that basically stable and preferential market access to the US is such a valuable commodity that they're willing to basically give up, any possibility of ever running an industrial policy ever again by sort of paying regulatory harmonization as a price for market access. But I won't do it. Or, Costa Rica and the Dominican Republic and the Central American countries are willing to do it, or the Chileans are willing to do it, but I won't do it. A rational policymaker might say that. But a rational policymaker, remember, is fighting for the pieces that are left of the US market. Now he's not just fighting for the pieces left of the US market that come from the fact that China's exporting so much, but the fact that neighboring countries, potentially countries that have similar export structures, now have better than most neighbor nation access, or better than I have access, because they've negotiated this agreement. So you get sort of a competitive dynamic among developing countries, which is one of the reasons why you have this proliferation of these agreements. How do you end the proliferation of the PPAs? Well, I'm basically saying, so far what I've said is that, in a nutshell, is that the real worry is deep integration. The developing countries have done a good job of stopping deep integration at the multilateral level, but they're basically buying deep integration bit by bit and sort of out-competing themselves to buy deep integration at the regional bilateral level. How do you stop that? Well, you can't stop it by just saying, we're not going to sign it. Because the whole problem is that there's this competitive dynamic that drives countries to sign it. The only way you can stop it, is to make the benefits of those agreements, the market access, less beneficial. And how do you do that? You make the margin that you get from having better than most favored nation access very small. Put it this way. If I use the example of cardboard boxes, I said the MFN tariff was 10%. Imagine the MFN tariff was 40%, right? But you can negotiate a special agreement in which you can export the cardboard boxes to my talk about actually a sector with no externalities and diminishing returns. But in any case, imagine this cardboard box was much more technologically sophisticated than it is. The point is that imagine that the tariff was 40%, okay, the MFN tariff. If I negotiate an agreement, I can get 0% access to it. Okay? So you have this incentive to negotiate these bilateral regional agreements. But if the developing countries can whittle down the MFN tariff across the board, so that basically the MFN tariff on this is 2%, then I negotiate a bilateral or regional agreement. I'm basically adopting this huge deep integration agenda, which I don't really want, for 2% tariff benefit. Suddenly it's not a good deal anymore. So the point that I'm making here is that the only way to stop the proliferation of PPA, which from my perspective is the real threat to development, the big threat to development, the fatal threat to development, one that threatens to lock an international division of labor in place in perpetuity. The only way to stop those, basically, is to make them less attractive. And the only way you make them less attractive is not by declaring a moratorium on them, but basically by lowering the MFN tariff, which means that the developing countries have an intense interest, actually in, perversely, in making this development rock, this development agenda succeed at a certain level so they can lower MFN tariffs across the board, okay, therefore to dampen the enthusiasm for these PPAs. So they're negotiating, but they don't want to basically give in massively to the concept to what's being demanded from the US and from the Europeans, so that's why you have these intense negotiations. So it's not because they necessarily buy this agenda, but it's because they know that the only way to stop the proliferation of PPAs is to basically lower tariffs at the multilateral level. And if they don't, then it's only a matter of time before one more country gets this agreement and the next country gets this agreement, and you're left there basically saying, you're left there in Latin America saying, well, you're the Brazilian government, and you're thinking, we're now the last country in Latin America that can export, that has to face an MFN tariff and export to the US. Everybody else gets preferential market access except for us. So now we'll do it too, and suddenly they're buying this deep integration agenda, which is Brazilian more than any other country in the world, but yet fighting tooth and nail to resist for the last 10 years. So I think that's what's driving it, and I will leave it there.
Can you repeat the question?
question.
The question was, I made a big deal about deep integration being about harmonizing regulatory standards, and I made a big deal about that being problematic. And the question was, can I explain what I mean by that, or give some examples of that? And the answer to that is yes, I can. And Jason, how can I do it very, very succinctly? Because there's many examples of that. But let me just give one or two examples in the area of intellectual property, which is the area that I work most closely on. And the way to think about this is to sort of think about sort of what the pre-Uruguay round status quo sort of arrangements were, what happened in the Uruguay round, and what the really deep integration looks like. Okay. So, for example, prior to the Uruguay round, countries could do whatever they wanted, basically, in managing their intellectual property. Patents, for example, they can decide, well, we'll give. We don't give patents on pharmaceuticals because we want to have our own generic pharmaceutical sector. And because pharmaceutical sector, unlike cardboard boxes, is an incredibly dynamic sector of an economy with huge amounts of linkages and increasing returns to sale and positive externalities. So everybody wants to have a pharmaceutical sector. How do you get a pharmaceutical sector? You basically don't allow patents on pharmaceuticals and providing a number of other things in place. A generic pharmaceutical sector will thrive. And many developing countries, most of the developing countries that you sort of think about are sort of the ones that experienced rapid industrial growth in the period after World War II, not just Korea and Taiwan, but also Brazil and Mexico and Argentina and India and so on, sort of the group of middle-income developing countries, that's what they did. Or you could say, I won't go on very long, or you could say, I'll get to your question, don't worry. Or you could say, you know, we give patents, but you know, that we have incredibly tight regulations on what the patent holder must do in order to keep the patent, because we want to make sure that this technology, this knowledge is shared with local firms, okay? So the whole idea is basically, if we're going to give protection to your knowledge, we want to make sure that our local firm benefits from this, and they can innovate it around it as well. The point is that prior to the Uruguay round, countries could configure their patent system any way they wanted, that they thought would be in the interest of economic development. The Uruguay round narrows this. It says you have to give patents on all sectors, so you can no longer do my pharmaceutical story. Okay? But it still gives countries a huge amount of leeway, actually, in terms of regulating patents. So I gave two examples, right? I said what you give patents on and how you regulate patents to assure technology transfer and local actors' ability to use knowledge. And I said that prior to the Uruguay round, they have whatever they want to do on both accounts. The Uruguay round took out the first one of those, but left the second one. Okay? So that's deep integration. It's a step towards harmonization, but it ain't harmonization yet, right? It still says that basically, you know, the Brazilians can basically tell, Motorola that if they want to have a patent on this chip in Brazil, that they must follow certain types of procedures that the U.S. government would never in a million years tell Motorola. Right? So it's deep integration and it's toward harmonization, but it's not yet harmonization. The sort of the hyper-deep integration that I refer to in these preferential trading arrangements, it takes that extra step as well. So it basically, it further says, not only can you not exclude patents on a certain sector because you want to develop that sector, but you basically cannot, essentially, to be very overly strong about it, perhaps a bit crude about it, you can't regulate the patent holder. Okay? Let them do whatever they want to do, and attempts to regulate them are now legal. A bit strong, but it generally speaks to the point. So that's an example of regulatory harmonization, and it's an example of regulatory harmonization that didn't exist pre-Uruguay round, exists, becomes formed during the Uruguay round, and exists in spades in these bilateral preferential agreements. Does that answer your question, or did I manage to talk 5 minutes without answering?
Well, the question is how do developed countries, such as the U.S., benefit from these preferential trade agreements?
Developed countries, benefit from regulatory harmonization because it allows them to develop global strategies with less concern about regulatory differences. That's what it comes down to. Right? So you have technologies allow for what you can call sort of the modularization of production. Technology allows you to basically break the production process into 15 different components and theoretically do each of those 15 things in 15 different locations depending on where the costs are, right? What prevents you from doing that
is regulatory, is differences in regulation. But the difference in regulation in 15 different jurisdictions are such that the costs that you face trying to sort of take advantage of modularized production are outweighed, or they're nullified by the benefits that you face with doing that are nullified by the costs that you face in doing that and dealing with all these regulatory issues. So developed countries' firms, and then they lobby developed countries, have an interest in something toward regulatory harmonization. That's why they benefit. That's why they benefit from it. That, and that's what's sort of driving the agenda.
I think the bottom line of all this is that although in the public discussion, the WTO and the WTO issues, the whole debate is normally treated as something over here, and then over here there are questions about regional trade unions. In fact, there's an intimate connection between what's happening in the WTO and what's happening in preferential trade unions, and they have to be considered within the same frame. The trade negotiations, especially for advanced countries, are playing off these two kinds of fora and getting kind of synergistic gains for themselves, in a sense, tipping the playing field even more in their favor by playing on the relationship between these two kinds of fora. So cannot be done with the WTO without also looking at what's happening in the WTO. Yes.
I'm curious for either of you, what record do you feel that developing countries are approaching these talks with as well? And what are the chances of actually changing the military process in the future?
So the question is, what bargaining leverage developing countries have in these trade negotiations, and what are the prospects that they can do what essentially what Ken was saying, to leverage down the room for preference to be given, preference of trade unions below the most favored nation ceiling. What kind of
well, I'm actually not very optimistic, to be honest, because I don't think they have much positive power. They have negative power. They can basically resist negotiating and therefore whittle down the agenda, which is what they did in Cancun, right? And they should basically allow this to be turned to a stalemate, which it looks like they're going to do, and saying it that way actually wins them the stalemate. The reason why they're long stalemate is demand for the main economy are quite huge. So, but I'm not sure if they can actually, the reason why I don't actually come to end at the same point as Rob about this is what they should do, which is sort of, walk away and try and get a new deal altogether, because I think if they had any ability to do that, they would do it, and they don't have any ability to do that. So I'm not optimistic about their power. The question is, how do you whittle down the MFN thing? And they can do it. It's just a question of how much they give in exchange. The reason why I'm not optimistic is I fear that they will ultimately, for the sake of getting really good market access in the World Trade Organization, so that the difference between MFN tariffs and what they give in preferential is so small that it basically reduces this proliferation of PPAs, that they'll give away too much on non-agricultural market access and on services. And I don't want to make a prediction as to whether they will or not, but that's what I worry about, to be honest. So they can do it. They can whittle down the MFN prediction and just basically say, yeah, sure, we'll take your agreement. But the question is what they have to do in exchange for that.
They do seem to me to be very weak in the sense that there are fundamental conflicts of interest within countries, developing countries, such as between food exporters, very small number now, and most of those countries who have become net food importers. So that fact of large differences of interest within the bloc does make it very difficult for them to insert an agenda. But the second thing, I wonder what you think about this, is that this whole thrust of negotiations is really all driven on the assumption that it is a tremendous advantage to get into the US market, especially the US market. U.S. market is the most buoyant. It's got this amazing kind of credit card culture, so that people buy like crazy, and it's very easy to sell in the American market once you get get in. But, I mean, there is the possibility of a dollar crash. The possibility is the probability that it's rising as the US trade deficit gets bigger and bigger and bigger. There is the possibility of a hard landing, of a recession in the US and possibly in other advanced countries as well. And in that case, the US market would be much less attractive. Developing countries would not be willing to give up so much deep integration in return for access to this wonderfully buoyant market, because the market wouldn't be buoyant.
Yeah, but you're absolutely correct, except for that. That only increases the incentives to do it now. Get in while it's still there. So that just basically, I mean, I agree that 100%. So it's another reason why these PTAs really don't make sense from a long-term perspective, because you're not even going to have this market for that much longer. Like, at some point, the dollar's got to come down, and that basically means harder exports of the US anyway, or the dollar's appreciating. So, but that just said, well then, that just increases the race to get in before that happens.
One more, yeah.
As a follow-up to that one, I was wondering if you could clarify whether they're actually acting as a bluff in terms of this margin, in terms of trying to reduce the margin, because what would be the incentive for the Mexicos or for the Chiles to try to reduce it? In fact, they probably have the other incentives, trying to keep the things as they are, because they have this bilateral agreement.
Did you hear after that?
I think that actually the countries that have these agreements have a huge incentive in... The question that Alfonso asked is why, countries already have preferential market access, what do they have to gain by sort of diluting that in the WTO? And I think that it sort of works both ways. The issue is that you have the preferential agreement gives you rents and you live off of these. You live off these rents. Mexico lives off these rents right now. Right? That's what drives the entire Mexican economy, is the fact that it has this preferential market access to the U.S. access to the U.S. market, which is a rent, a big rent. And it's the MFN levels in the U.S. in the WTO are never going to reach the levels of PTA. In other words, the scope, the amount of things that are going to be liberalized, the number of sectors that are going to be liberalized, and the level of market access are never going to be as much in the WTO as in the preferential agreements. So Mexico will always have sort of a leg up on the countries in the WTO. So the point I'm saying is you're not going to eliminate the whole world of better than better, most favored nations. You're just trying to make it small enough to reduce the incentive to get it. What the Mexicans are worried about is not a WTO that has very low MFN tariffs. What Mexico is worried about is a proliferation of FTAs with Chile and everybody else in Latin America that gives everybody the same access to the US market that Mexico has. Which is why I think it's so interesting that ever since Mexico signed NAFTA, they've become one of the most active participants in the WTO, in strengthening the WTO, hosting many ministerials, hosting the ministerial, being the head of a number of councils in the WTO. Especially the Council on IPR is going to be its most contentious part. I mean, it looked like the WTO might collapse over the conflict over it. Because countries that have these agreements, you're right that they're partially threatened by a lowering of MFN tariffs across the board, but what they're really threatened by is a proliferation of... Mexico is more threatened by the US-Chile PTA than it is by anything that happens in Doha or in Hong Kong.
Just one final point about PTAs. And capital controls. We know that there was this attempt in the mid-90s, an attempt to change the articles of the agreement of the IMF to make it really a requirement of membership of the IMF that countries gave up any kind of capital controls. They have to have free capital movements, no restrictions on capital flows across the border. And finally, that effort was sunk, partly by the Asian crisis. But countries like the US and also the European Commission are very keen to have the whole world move to open capital markets. And the US in particular is making it a condition of, I think, all of its preferential trade agreements that the country or countries on the other end of the agreement, such as Singapore or Chile, agree that they will never ever put restrictions on capital flows, such as exchange restrictions, or if they do, and this is the Singapore US free trade agreement, if they do, there's an elaborate compensation formula for American investors who will be compensated for any losses that they give, such as a result of the exchange restrictions, which gives the government of Singapore a strong disincentive ever to put on capital control restrictions. So this is a way through the PTA, Preferential Trade Agreement, this is a way, in a sense, through the back door to get lots of countries in the world committed to free capital movement. And then at a later point, it would be possible to introduce it into the WTO or the IMF or some other multilateral forum and make it a world policy. That's, I think, the policy going on.
Okay. Can I comment about that? Is there any conflict between the US and the EU on precisely that issue? Because these restrictions on capital, on equal amounts of capital, the US has in the PTA, as Robert said, the US also has them in bilateral investment treaties. It has a lot of countries, more countries than the PTA, but it has just straight bilateral investment treaties. The bilateral investment treaties get integrated into PTAs. So Mexico and the US have a bilateral investment treaty with the chapter of NAFTA, but a lot of countries just have bilateral investment treaties without the rest of the stuff. And the US PTA say this, but the European PTA, BITs, my own to say this, the European Union BITs don't, and they allow countries to basically split up restrictions on capital flows through periods of economic crisis. When these new countries of East and Central Europe, 10 new countries, joined the European Union last year, a few of them, I think three of them, Poland is one of them, I think Slovenia, I'm not sure the other one, but three of them, had bilateral investment treaties with the US, which said, you cannot put up restrictions on capital flows, regardless of the circumstance, even in the case of extreme national emergency, if you do what Robert was saying, you're going to compensate, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Compensate the US.
Compensate. And the European Union said, no, you can do that. And this agreement that you have with the US contravenes the agreement you have with us. And so you have this sort of this trilateral dispute in which the Polish government says the US, we have to renegotiate our PIT. And the US says, no, we're not going to renegotiate our PIT. So the Polish government goes to Brussels and says, we can't renegotiate our PIT. And the European Union says, if you want to join the European Union, you have to renegotiate your PIT. So the Polish government goes back to the US. It's like, we'll kick it back and forth. And finally, it got settled between Brussels and Washington. And in this particular instance, the US, the EU prevailed. And that those aspects of the US PITs got being voted. But the point is, it speaks for the whole set of international political issues around and the BIT web is much bigger than the PTA web. The countries get the BIT supporting it. Yes.
That would be a great participation target. just what Ken was talking about to kind of unravel. It's okay. Just what Ken was talking about.